Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us John O'Connor, who grew up in Connecticut, New Mexico, and Iowa. After a year in college, he earned a living doing factory construction, custodial, and other unskilled work until he recorded an album of his original songs on Flying Fish Records and began an unlikely career as a folk singer and songwriter, touring on the U.S. coffeehouse circuit. In the late 90s, he began working as a union organizer and publishing his poetry in various literary journals, Sycamore Review, Baltimore Review, Columbia Journal of Arts and Literature, Indiana Review, Seneca Review, and Silk Road, to name a few. His poems have been nominated twice for a Pushcart Prize, and he has won the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Prague Prize. He lives in Vermont and central New York State. His first book of poems, Half the Truth, won the 2015 Violet Reed Haas Prize for Poetry. Rachel Zucker writes of it, in the spirit of James Wright and Philip Levine, but with a style, grace, and humor all his own, John O'Connor revisits and reinvents the working man's American lyric of failure and redemption, beauty and honesty. You can learn more about John today in our conversation, but also by visiting him at johnpaulo'connor.com, and that's johnpaulo'connor.com. Welcome to the program, John.
Oh, it's good to be talking to you, Sheila.
I'm glad to have had the opportunity to meet you earlier this year when you were on tour singing your folk songs and did a stop in Port Townsend. And I know some of our listeners have heard you already speak about your music on our station, and I was unaware that you were also a poet and quite thrilled to find your poetry book there on the table with your CDs and then to read the poems. After I'd listened to you during your concert read them, they're really moving. They really bring back a lot of memories for me because I lived in Seattle prior to here, and I arrived in Seattle in 1972 when it was something of a different place than it is now, and your poetry certainly brought that back. Earlier this morning, I was looking at your website, and I read your essay about how you came to poetry, and especially about the influence of Philip Levine, who's always been one of my very favorite poets as well. You did such a good job in that essay of describing how you came to poetry, and I wonder if we could start our conversation there. Can you recount a little bit of how poetry came into your life, or your writing of it?
Sure. I guess I'm kind of an accidental poet. I think poetry basically came to me because of alienation. I think this is true of a lot of people, alienation they felt in high school. But I'd always had an interest in writing since I was 10 after reading Mark Twain, and I thought these dreams of being a novelist. And so I took a creative writing class when I went to high school. It was the only thing that was of interest to me. And so I dabbled in poetry, and I wrote really crappy adolescent poetry for a long time. And then I was really kind of detoured through my interest in folk music, and that's really where my focus went. Up until I was almost 50 years old, my late 40s, and I had been writing a few poems, reading a few poets, but when I moved from Seattle to Greenfield, Massachusetts, and my folk music career was not looking great, I decided to take a class with a poet named Robert Long. He's a really great poet who lives in Oregon now. He turned me on to some poets, and I started reading contemporary poetry, a lot of it. And then I started really in earnest trying to write good poetry. And Philip Levine was, I think, one of my models. And I'm always kind of shocked because I felt I was just really imitating him. I was shocked to find that when people read my poetry, they didn't see Philip Levine at all in it. They didn't detect it anyway. So that was of interest to me. What I borrowed from Philip Levine was using memory in a way that is sometimes shifted and exaggerated and taken liberties with. And then, of course, his affinity to the working class in Detroit really resonated with me because his early career as a factory worker really paralleled my early years when after high school I was doing factory work for about 3 or 4 years. So this is kind of a new world open to me rather late in life. And I concentrated on that, and I was sending out poems and really not paying as much attention to music, although recently I've gotten back into doing some touring and singing. So I've kind of combined the two enterprises, singing and reading poems, and it's worked out quite well.
I heard that in your concert here in Port Townsend, you not only sang songs and introduced them beautifully, but you read poems at times. And that was a first experience for me to have a songwriter switch genres. And a lot of people think that lyrics and poetry are similar. A lot of poets don't think so. So another question I have for you is about how that works for you, writing lyrics versus writing poetry.
They're really two different worlds. A lot of people ask me if I thought about putting my poems to music and banish the thought. I think it would ruin the poem. But I think very few lyrics that are written in songs, even the best songwriters, really do well on the page or read without the melody as poetry. It just doesn't work. And I think a good example of that is Dylan's statement after he was given the Nobel Prize for Literature. He basically said, what I write is not literature.
You know, I remember
it's
that.
Songs.
Yeah.
I think a rare exception to that, I think, is Leonard Cohen, who I always thought if you were going to give a prize for literature, he's the songwriter that should get it, because a lot of his lyrics do actually read well on the page. I think it's a rare exception, and it doesn't really work. So the mind of writing songs is completely different, I think, than the mind that writes poems.
Can you address that at all? It's a really hard thing for people who aren't familiar with those differences to really understand. Do you have words for that?
I suppose that in the days when writing poetry in form was much more common, pacing and rhyme and meter was paid more attention to, the two enterprises were probably closer to each other. And I do know of songwriters who have taken melodies and taken, say, Yeats' poem or William Blake or something and set them to music quite successfully, but that's a different enterprise, I think. These days, in free form, there's a direction, I think, that the writing mind takes that is different than songwriting. Songwriting is, first of all, propped up by melody and rhyme, and also you can break a lot of rules in songwriting because the melody and the scanning of the lyric in juxtaposition to meter can be done quite well if you just cram a bunch of syllables into one place where it's only supposed to be two syllables. So that sort of thing works in songwriting where it doesn't really work in writing poetry on the page. Personally, it's a difference of a mindset because I think my poetry writing is much, much more introspective and takes a lot more time to prepare for. I mean, mind space. I need a good half a day at least to write a poem or to even start a first draft of a poem because I really need to clear my head out and really get into sort of a zone. Where songwriting, when I was writing songs a lot, I would just walk down the street and I'd be on my way doing something else and an idea for a lyric and a melody would pop into my head and they came into my head simultaneously. I could, after a walk, come home and have the first verse and chorus of the song ready to go.
That's exciting.
I remember one time writing a song, and when I was at work, I was working a job as an inventory clerk. I had an idea, and I went to the closet and wrote down this song. In about 15 minutes, most of the song was done, and I came out and went back
well,
to work.
Well, that's something I think a lot of poets would be very jealous of. So
yeah.
You say that you'll be walking, something physical, walking, and a song will come to you, lyrics will come to you. How does a poem come?
I think poems comes from reading poetry, for mm-hmm. one thing. I think reading poetry doesn't come easily. And I think if you're going to read a poem, you really have to make space for that poem because it's intense language and it operates on several levels. And the enjoyment of reading a poem is much more different than, say, reading fiction or nonfiction. It's just, I think it takes a little bit more care. Not that it's necessarily difficult. It just takes some focus. And so I think that's the same thing that is required of somebody who writes a poem. You have to be prepared to have your writing mind kind of clear out your everyday reality to get to a place where metaphor and allegory and all that stuff is going to work without it feeling forced.
Right. So maybe this is a good time for us to hear one of your poems and see how that operates for you.
Well, this is a poem I wrote several years ago, and it uses memory a lot. It's, I think, kind of a trademark of a lot of my poems, not all of them, but it's called Beans. The way my father told the story, it wasn't Jack who climbed the beanstalk. It was my sister and I. We were very, very poor, and my mother asked us to go sell the cow, whose part my father gave to our dog, Igor. How sad I felt for my mother, who was so desperate as to send her two young children out into the world to bring home food for the family. Was this why I discovered her one afternoon in her bedroom, sheer white curtains feeding light onto her face as she wept? When we came home with only beans to show for the cow we sold, what else could you get for a cow that resembled a black Labrador? She screamed hysterically and sent us to our rooms without supper, throwing the beans out the back door with a disillusionment that was always with her. The narrator hid from the picture, omniscient and absent, spending his time at the Amvet Hall or at Nick's Tavern, where he learned the art of long, elaborate tales, which he told only on the occasional nights when he drank at home and we gathered around curious to know who he was. If he were sober, he stayed behind his newspaper and called for his supper like the giant at the top of the beanstalk, growling at his tiny wife. Had he enough to drink, the story would continue and the giant became what we always hoped he would, a kind soul who did work, good work for the people of the kingdom. But this wasn't a kingdom. It was a four-bedroom house in Albuquerque in 1958, when there were no giants, but plenty of dogs and children and drunken fathers whose wives wept in the privacy of their afternoons and yelled for their children at supper time. Food was on each table, and from my window I traced the long trunk of a poplar tree to its top, where white flimsy clouds could hold a thing.
Thank you so much. I feel the depth that you're talking about in poetry and the way you have to work hard to get to that space. And I'm remembering that a teacher of mine, Robert Haas, always said, poems are written in layers, that there are many things in one poem. What was your work like on this poem? Did it come hard? Did it come easily? Were you aware of painting in more layers?
No, it comes, I think, easily in the sense most good poems, I'll risk saying that this is probably true of most poets, the first drafts come fairly easily, that the different levels are there in the first draft without a lot of effort, immediate effort, the effort of the moment, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of effort that comes from years and years of reading and looking at poetry. And then I think crafting the poem so that it gets that original punch that you felt when you were writing it takes several hours, maybe several days, maybe several weeks after you've gotten the first draft, just to make sure that everything's in line and that what you're reading is actually not just some echo of what you thought you were saying.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good way to put it.
That's all part of revision, I think.
Yeah, not just an echo of something you thought you were saying. I love that because the poems do contain information we had no idea we were saying or going to say. I think one of the words I use, you said it, listening. When you look at your first draft, there's a deep listening that goes on to see what are the words saying? Where are they leading me? Your words have that narrative going about Jack and the Beanstalk, and then they end with the whole society that you grew up in, what it was like for families.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with poet and songwriter John O'Connor about how he turned to writing poetry at age 50, learned from the great poets, and eventually won a literary contest that included the publication of his first book of poems.
So you mentioned before, like Philip Levine, you take a certain, I guess I'll call it liberty, exaggeration. Do you find that operating in this poem?
Yeah, the original idea of the poem was this story my dad used to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was in Albuquerque. I grew up in three different places.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know if it was in Connecticut or Albuquerque. I heard the story. I remember it was there. And I think the image of my mother, she had these white sheer curtains in her bedroom that I remember. You know, the breeze would come through them.
Mm-hmm.
She'd be napping. was that in Albuquerque? I don't know if it was or not. There are images that are not necessarily accurate descriptions of what is going on. And especially for me, because personally there's three geographical demarcations in my growing up: Connecticut, New Mexico, Iowa. And all three of them have real intense, meaningful memories to me, mm-hmm. Different worlds, and they get mixed up.
So the reason this is New Mexico is perhaps just a mix-up, or perhaps there's something poetic about the syllables in New Mexico, or maybe...
I think that's true. The other thing is the music. Poets talk about the music in the poetry, and if the music's not right, you just don't have a poem. So you can have the most moving idea, but if you haven't got a way to deliver it, that's not going to sound manufactured, or it's not going to sound pushed. Poem's just not going to work. New Mexico, Albuquerque, 1958,
yeah.
is something
yeah.
that I think jolts you first out of the direction of that narration in that poem. All of a sudden, it's not a kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's Albuquerque in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the poem turns. And I think in a good poem, you'll have that seminal turn that kind of breaks out of where the poem is coming from and where it's meant to go.
Right. And it's very moving when that happens. And it makes us all, as readers, think about where were we when and what was our family like. The title, Beans, it's a perfect title. It has a lot of resonance. Do you feel that? Do you know how you came to call it Beans?
Well, it was called Giant for a long time.
Ah.
I just went back and forth between
right.
those two titles when I had it published. It's when it stayed Beans.
Yes, I like Beans. I think it makes me think about a lot of things, how small children are in this whole
yeah.
unit.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think about beans sprout and what happens yeah. to children mm-hmm. of alcoholics, and just so much in it. I really like
it. There's yeah. a lot in that word.
So I have to ask you perhaps a stupid question. Did the children actually sell the Labrador?
No.
Good.
The story, the cows sold.
Right. So the
and
kids.
And my father, that was one thing that he gave me, is that idea that he had that called the cow Igor. And Igor uh-huh. was our black Labrador.
Right. Right. Maybe it was just because I was just a first listen, but because of the seriousness of the mother crying and because the kids can take stories really seriously, I did have to ask
yeah.
that question.
Yeah, it's
so
true.
I'd love to hear another poem now that we're speaking about your poetry directly. Do you have another selection?
I don't write political poems much, as opposed to, you know, there's a lot of politics in my songs. But on days when I've gone out to write, darkness has descended upon me.
Yes.
in these days, in this era, and things just happen. This is a poem that I wrote when I came out to Seattle in 2016. Northwest Labor History Association had hired me to come out to sing. They were recreating the ship on the Verona to go up to Everett to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Everett Massacre. And so I was in town just 2 days after the election. Some friends of mine and I went out drinking, and this poem came from that experience. And the poem's called The Fall. My old friend and I walked down the sidewalk after drinking beer and whiskey at the pub and despairing over the election of the new president. Walk is the wrong word, at least for my friend, who is in a wheelchair he's occupied since he fell from a roof 35 years ago. We haven't gone half a block when his front casters hit the edge of a section of sidewalk, heaved up half an inch, and his chair halts with a jolt, and he pitches forward and lands spread eagle on the concrete. At exactly the same time, the toes of my shoes stumble on the same edge of pavement, and I arrive next to my friend as if we are bunkmates flopping belly first onto our mattresses. I pick myself up and look at the atrophied legs crumpled beneath him as he lifts his torso upright and wonders aloud in a panicked tone whether one of them might be broken. He wouldn't know. The pain that comes with crushed limbs hasn't lived in his legs for decades. He can't get himself up, and I don't have the strength to lift him properly back into the seat of his chair. Help arrives, stragglers from the nearby bar. He's back in his chair, and I'm on my feet, humbled that we are two drunks who have been face down near the gutter, and we are old drunks who would appear to most of the world as pathetic and beyond empathy. Our jeans are torn and dirty, and the country of our birth has just elected a fascist to lead a drunken nation down a road of frost heaves and potholes toward a cliff. I walk with my friend to his car, help him make his transfer in front of the steering wheel, and place his chair wheels in the back seat. Then he is gone, and I walk the other way, over the Fremont Bridge, below the misted street lamps, wondering if his legs are all right, before I hear my own voice speaking to the darkened sky. Well, of course they're not all right.
This poem, too, takes that turn when, although you've planted it early in the poem about the election, then you say, and the drunken nation has elected the fascist. So once again, you've done that in your poem and brought me someplace beyond the incident that you're talking about, the falling. Very, very strong poem. It leaves me speechless, actually, and that's not a good thing when you're doing a radio interview.
Well, I have to say that incident was a gift. Poor Kurt was part of it, but I mean, he was okay. I wrote this poem the next day, and it was pretty much complete when I wrote it. I did some revision of it, but I sent it to him right away, and he was just delighted with it. He has a very gallows sense of humor. I had to get his okay for the poem first before I sent it out to anybody.
Even as a listener to the poem, I feel that sense of humor when you describe the belly flopping as if you were bedmates falling on a mattress, and the way your jeans are torn, and not only drunk, but an old drunk. Just brought me right along with it.
And to me, the title of the poem says everything. It's called The Fall. And in the poem is this personal episode, but the bigger fall, we've run into this edge, and quite by surprise, everybody's on the floor and completely shocked by what has just happened. And I think that was what was such a gift. Is this? It was like God came down and threw a poem at me. I think he must have raised the ledge up of that sidewalk. It's funny, I went back to the scene of the accident last time I was in Seattle, and somebody had come out with some blacktop and had repaired the edge.
Oh. So no one else gets that gift, huh? It's funny how we all, when we're poets, contradict ourselves. And rarely, but sometimes a poem does come easily. And the floodgates are open in some way, and we're able to write even about a very fresh experience. But The Fall is a perfect title. It's the fall of a whole nation about to happen. It just really tugs at me. So you have a bit of a publishing story when it came to publishing your poems, not only in the journals that I listed in your bio, but in your book, Half the Truth. Tell us a little bit about that story. You said you came to writing poetry late-ish. You said 50, which is a good time because then we don't have to write about teenage angst. We have all kinds of other angst.
Yeah.
But then you had a journey in getting your poems into a volume. So what was that like?
Well, it was a long journey. It's not easy to get published, especially if you're not in the academy, you know, if you're not in the world of... I think these days it's a lot of publishing is done through connections that people make in these writing programs, these MFA programs. I think you're at a disadvantage if you're not there. It took me at least 10 years of sending out manuscript before somebody took it. And in this day and age of poetry, what is happening is most first volumes of poems, I would venture to say, come through people entering these book contests that small publishers put out to help fund their publishing. And they charge an entry fee, and usually they pay $1,000 or $2,000 prize in publishing a first book. And that's what happened with me after about a dozen years. The manuscript, of course, wasn't the same manuscript the whole way through. It had changed over the years. So it has a lot of breadth to it. The work goes back over a period of almost 15 years.
Well, sometimes things do happen in their right time, so this isn't the manuscript that we would have all received if it had been published earlier. So
it's a better manuscript.
Yeah, that's a good attitude. So how long has the book been out now?
came out at the end of 2015.
But you are continuing to write poetry?
I'm still writing poetry, yeah. I'm not ready for a second book yet.
Do you find differences in the shape or sound or subject matter?
I'm not writing as much, for one thing. Part of reintroducing my career in touring, I was away from singing and touring for quite a long time, and going back into that has taken a lot of my creative energy and time. That's one thing. The other thing is that I don't have as much work to choose from to put together a manuscript that I'm happy with. So I'm still waiting to write more poems before. And I'm not in a hurry to do this. I don't need to have another book out right away. But I hope to maybe in a year or so.
You've been a poet and a songwriter who's writing about serious things when it comes to working people, to union activists, to just the need for this country to be more humane. And how do you feel about the place of healing stories in our culture right now?
I don't know how we could live without it. I think there's a lot of it going on, isn't there? I'm hearing a lot of songs, hearing a lot of poems, essays. There's a lot of really great work coming out. I don't even know where to start to talk about it, but I think it's essential. I can't remember who said this. There's some famous quote about if poetry didn't exist, we'd have to invent it or something like that.
Yeah.
Some really famous person said that. I don't know who. But I think it's true. I think it's part of who we are as human beings.
Absolutely.
And if you go outside of the United States, and you're seeing a lot of what's so great about the changing world, because we're exposed to this immigration of people from different parts of the world right now, and we're reading poems from Iraq, we're reading poems from Africa. Not only are we discovering contemporary writers who are here that are writing other stories from other countries, but we're also being introduced to important writers in other parts of the world. And I have mixed emotions about the modern world because I think at heart I'm very conservative. I don't like change. But on the other hand, the world is opening up, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful wide world of writing and people who are resisting in such great creative ways. Good for the heart, whether or not you win the battle or not. I felt this for a very long time, and mostly I would say this about my songwriting, is that it's the struggle that is as important as what you try to achieve by the struggle, because it's what keeps us human. I think that struggle that comes through the writing is the most powerful of all. I think it was John Berger, the essayist and novelist from England who died last couple of years. He talked about a miner who was involved in unionism and was an activist, and he said, even though the miner had made great influence in his activism, if that miner could become a writer, he would prefer him to be a writer, because that's where the power is.
And it's a fine place for us to end this conversation, because it's such an endearing and important message. And I thank you for giving it to us. And thank you for being on the program today. I really, really appreciated your words and your poems. Thank you, John.
Well, thanks so much, Sheila. I enjoyed it.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.